this, and the development of ideas about special creation, how Darwin dealt with them, and I've implied some of the developments afterwards, but I'm not going to give you a history of science course right now. We're going to proceed now to the refutations, and first we'll have 10 minutes from the negative, 10 minutes from the positive, 10 more minutes from the negative, 10 more from the positive, and then we will go to a question-answer session, and we will try to alternate the positive and the negative. And will you please, when we ask questions, make them very pointed and rather concise. We'll now go to the negative.
Dr. Morris talked a lot about the improbability of evolution happening. When you extrapolate probabilities, of course, you're going outside the realm of data. So let's see the amusing thing that Mark Twain said about extrapolating data. In the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi has shortened itself by 242 miles. That is an average of a trifle over a mile and three quarters per year. Therefore, any calm person who is not blind or idiotic can see that in the Oolithic Silurian period, just a million years ago next November, the lower Mississippi River was upward of 1,300,000 miles long and stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. And by the same token, any person can see that just 742 years from now, the lower Mississippi would only be a mile and three quarters long. And Cairo and New Orleans would have joined their streets together and been plodding along comfortably under a single mayor and mutual board of aldermen. There is something fascinating about this kind of science. It gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment in fact. Now, let's talk about the second law of entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, entropy. There is absolutely no data which shows whether entropy decreases with an increase in complexity. No data that shows that with an increase of complexity, you must get a decrease in entropy. If there is no data, experimental or observational, then the creationist assertion is based purely on their belief. It is not a scientific refutation at all. If you wish to believe this position, that's fine, but don't call that position scientific, nor do not claim that an invalidation of the evolutionary position. It is only their opinion. All other criticism that they gave which follows is irrelevant if there is no data. Let's talk about transitions and intermediates. It would take me several hours to correct, perhaps, the ideas embodied in creationist literature concerning my favorite subject, the evolution of vertebrates. The so-called difficulties of transitional forms are said by creationists to be one of the major refutations of the evolutionary process. In fact, it is only, as I've said before, it is only a partial refutation of one particular evolutionary theory, that of classical Darwinianism, which all of us gave up between 50 and 30 years ago. I'll use one example. Up in the slide box there, could you give me the third slide of the evolutionist carousel? I'll use Archaeopteryx, an example, we say, of an intermediate between the archosaurian reptiles, that is, the kind, including the extinct dinosaurs, flying reptiles, and the living crocodiles, and the archosaurian birds, generally termed avies. Now, Archaeopteryx has feathers, but in almost every other respect, it looks like a small reptile, or more specifically, a small dinosaur. If you look at this slide, on the top is an outline drawing of the skull of a small dinosaur. The bottom is an outline drawing of a bird. In between is Archaeopteryx. There is no doubt that if the feather imprints of Archaeopteryx were not preserved, we would classify Archaeopteryx as a reptile. In fact, we are now turning up specimens of Archaeopteryx in European museums that went unrecognized and were classified as small dinosaurs because they did not leave feather imprints when they were preserved. Now, the creationists would say that since Archaeopteryx is classified as a bird, it cannot be a bird-reptile transitional form. With all due apology, I must say that this conclusion belies a basic misunderstanding about how organisms are classified and a basically simplistic attitude towards intermediates. Our classification system is based on the Linnaean system. Linnaeus was a creationist and believed in the Aristotelian essence of things. That is to say, he believed that if a thing had a certain name property, then it was always placed in one particular place, whether it be a classification or a room or whatever. Because of Linnaeus's tradition, our classification system is made up of a number of boxes. Each box has a list of characteristics, which defines what goes into that box. In the case of birds, the list is very short. If it has feathers, it goes into the avian box. At present, there is no box in our system of classification for a transitional form between the so-called reptiles and the birds. This is the reason that Archaeopteryx is placed with other birds. We may wonder if our classification that we use is adequate. Indeed, I personally don't think it is. But whether or not Archaeopteryx is an intermediate between birds and reptiles does not depend on its classification. It depends on its morphology, its body plan. And clearly, its body plan is transitional between reptiles and birds. Reptiles, with a quote. Of course, it is possible that you may prefer not to believe this. There is nothing I can do if you wish to believe that way. But look at the skulls. Now, if Archaeopteryx is a transitional form, where are all the other transitional forms hidden in the classification? Should we change the classification? Well, I don't know. That'll depend on how science wants to go. But it would seem to me that if Archaeopteryx is a transitional form, there's no reason why a lot of other things shouldn't be either. Lights, please. So, extrapolation gets a lot of distance with no data. The second law of thermodynamics is not violated by evolution. In fact, we have no data whatsoever to see whether the second law of thermodynamics either refutes or corroborates evolution. So how can we argue about the second law of thermodynamics without any data? Transitional and intermediate forms? I gave you Archaeopteryx. Perhaps you can think of some more. What is a virus? A virus is a thing that exhibits some of the characteristics of non-life. It produces crystals. And it doesn't even have any DNA. It has RNA and a simple protein coat. Biologists have argued for a long time whether viruses are living or non-living. It would seem reasonable to think that viruses were intermediate. As far as Australopithecus and such things as that go, and, you know, Leakey saying, well, he had demolished all theories about the evolution of man, ladies and gentlemen, that's what we're out to do. We want to demolish the old theories and replace them with better theories. After all, if falsification is the object that we want to strive for because it gives us objectivity, then it's not surprising to me at all that Leakey would exult in the fact that he has destroyed the old theories of human evolution. And we should exult in it because it means that we have more new and interesting things to do. I think that concludes my first negative rebuttal. Thank you very much.
And now we're going to hear another statement from the affirmative side.
I think both Dr. Gish and I would agree that we've enjoyed this dialogue, discussion, debate very much, and that both Dr. Bickford and Dr. Wiley have been very worthy opponents. Now, there's a great deal that I would like to say, and only have 10 minutes to say it, so that you'll have to take that limitation into consideration. One thing that I do wish to correct, though, at first, very often when we quote from evolutionists, people suggest that we quote out of context, and we always, of course, give the references so that if anyone questions whether we're doing that or not, they can go check them out. I would suggest that in referring to our book, Scientific Creationism, Dr. Wiley has quoted out of context a number of times, and I would commend to you to go look it up and see what is actually said there. He said, for example, that creationists say that evolutionists say this and that and the other thing. What we have suggested in this introductory chapter defining the two models is that the two models should be defined in their simplest terms, and in their simplest terms proceed to make predictions or retrodictions, if you wish, concerning things in the past, and then, if necessary, modify the models to make them fit the data. Now, that's what can be done in both cases. And we simply suggested that the evolution model in its simplest, basic, primary form suggested these predictions. Let me just quote what I said with respect to this. It should be noted that the tabulated predictions, he was referring to a table here in which a number of very simplistic predictions were made from each of the two models in a table without discussion. And it should be noted that the tabulated predictions are predictions of the primary models as defined in their most general terms, as in the foregoing discussion. These primary models may be modified by secondary assumptions to fit certain conditions. For example, the basic evolution model may be extended to include harmful as well as beneficial mutations, but this is not a natural prediction of the basic concept of evolution, and by that we mean that the idea that evolution suggests how things have evolved over the ages from particles to people, a tremendous increase in complexity, obviously. There must be then some basic primary mechanism requiring them to do that, and so these changes, mutations call them, must be ultimately, in the last analysis, beneficial. But in the primary evolution model, you would not, in its simplest terms, predict harmful mutations. Now, the model has to be extended and modified to include the harmful mutations, but of course you can do that, particularly in the view of the retrodictive aspect of these discussions. If the predictions of evolution, as listed in the above table, were actually observed in the natural world, they would, of course, in every case, be enthusiastically acclaimed as strong confirmations of the evolution model. In other words, if all that we did see were beneficial mutations, this would immediately be tremendously good evidence for evolution, and the creationists would have a very difficult time explaining that. Well, I don't want to take more time on that because there are many other things. I would just suggest that you read the entire discussion see exactly what it is that the basic evolution model would naturally predict before it's modified to account for the problems and difficulties. He also suggested that we extrapolated in our discussion of probability. The discussion of probability did not involve extrapolation, but simply an application of probability theory, very simple probability theory. We're not the only ones who have suggested that the complexity of living systems is extremely difficult to explain in terms of any natural random process, such as either random mutation or random genetic drift or whatever particular mechanism you want to suggest, or a naturalistic, unguided, undesigned, unprogrammed process. For example, Dr. Murray Eden at MIT in the symposium entitled Mathematical Challenges to the Neo-Darwinian Interpretation of Evolution, and that has to do, of course, with random mutations and natural selection, he says it is our contention that if random is given a serious and crucial interpretation from a probabilistic point of view, the randomness postulate is highly implausible, and so an adequate scientific theory of evolution will have to await the discovery and elucidation of new natural law. The present system will not account for the origin of complex systems from less complex systems by any random process. That's just not heard of in the real world. And so our discussion of the improbability of complex systems arising by any random process stands and has not been refuted, as a matter of fact, not even discussed. Now, in the main addresses of both of our opponents, neither one did deal with the precise subject of our discussion. Dr. Wiley largely devoted his discussion to a refutation of the flood model of geology as over against the uniformitarian model. Dr. Bickford largely to a discussion of a refutation of the young earth concept as over against an old earth concept. We recognize these are related to the basic issue of creation and evolution, but they're not the basic issue we're discussing tonight. to really deal with this subject adequately, we should have a debate on whether or not the flood model is a better model to explain the geological strata and fossils. We should also have a separate discussion on whether or not the scientific evidence supports a young Earth or an old Earth. The basic issue of creation or evolution is not affected in either case by this. We're not talking about biblical creation models. But only the basic question of whether evolution as a model explains the origin and development of life from primeval simplicity to its present extreme complexity. We've tried to show in terms of both probability and thermodynamics that it does not happen at present according to basic natural law. And from the fossil record, there's no evidence that it happened in the past. The point at issue in this evening should have been, it seems to us, whether or not the evolutionary model gives scientific evidence supporting evolution. I would suggest to you that the discussions of our opponents were directed at negating certain statements in what they interpret to be the discussion of creationism in our books, but they did not give any positive evidence for evolution. Nothing was given of that sort at all. Now, the second law of thermodynamics was sort of passed off as irrelevant, as I was afraid would be done, by just saying that there's no evidence that complexity and entropy have any relation to each other. And, of course, it was hard for me to really believe that he said that, but I believe that's what he said. The second law of thermodynamics does say, very specifically, it is stated in various forms, of course. There are different ways of stating it. Deals with the unavailability of energy, with the decrease of order, with the garbling of information. There are various ways that you can state it. But very definitely, the subject of information, complexity, order, these are all essentially synonymous terms. And the second law of thermodynamics says that entropy tends to increase, which means order, organization, complexity tends to decrease. There certainly is a relation. Let me quote from the article, The Arrow of Time, by David Laser in the 1975 December Scientific American. He says, a gain of information is always compensated for by an equal loss of entropy. Now, there's a very definite relation. If you have an increase of complexity, you have to have a loss of entropy. But the second law of thermodynamics says entropy always tends to increase. And I've tried to point out that entropy can decrease and complexity can increase in open systems under certain very special conditions, and only those special conditions, of a directing program and a conversion motor or mechanism to accomplish the transformation of the available environmental energy into the specific work of building up the complexity of the system. And these necessary criteria are not satisfied, so far as any evidence goes as yet, in evolution. And I did mention also Dr. Smith in Biosystems, 1975, Problems with Entropy in Biology. And he's an evolutionist, and he's trying to solve this problem, as certain others are. Some evolutionists are trying to solve it. Most ignore it, but some are trying to solve it. And he did say that this is one of the most fundamental unsolved problems in biology. It isn't solved yet. Now, there's not time, really, to deal with flood geology or the age of the Earth. These were not the main issues, but since so much was made of them, let me just say a word or two in the time that I have, and that's not very much. The question of whether the geological strata were formed slowly over long ages, as in the suggested discussion of the Grand Canyon, or perhaps were formed rapidly, I think is now being reconsidered by many geologists. My own graduate minor was geology, and so I've been particularly interested in my major in hydrology, so studying particularly the sedimentary processes that form rocks and so on. And I would suggest to you that the more information that comes in concerning sedimentary formations in relation to modern sedimentary processes, so-called evaporite formations in correspondence to modern salt flats and so on, and all the other types of formations, the more it becomes evident that all formations in the geologic column cannot be accounted for in terms of present processes operating at present rates. The very interesting quotation from Mark Twain was given, and we often use that same quotation to show the fallacy in the uniformitarian principle, that you can't work from present rates into the past. Now, an interesting book was published just recently, and all I can do is just make one quotation from it. Dr. Derek Ager, Nature of the Stratigraphic Record, head of the geology department at the Swansea University in England. His entire book is devoted to demonstrating what I just said, that every basic type of formation in the geologic column must have been formed by at least some sort of a regional or local catastrophe. He says this, the hurricane, the flood, the tsunami may do more in an hour or a day than the ordinary processes of nature can achieve in 1,000 years. That almost sounds like the Bible. One day is with a catastrophe as 1,000 years. Given all the millennia we have to play with and the stratigraphic record, we can expect our periodic catastrophes to do all the work we want of them. And then he closes his book this way. In other words, he says, the history of any one part of the earth, like the life of a soldier, consists of long periods of boredom and short periods of terror. What you see, in other words, in the geological column, the strata, the fossils, the formations, is the result of catastrophism. The very existence of fossils indicates this. What you don't see, the long intermediate missing ages, the gaps, not only in the fossils, but in the sedimentary process, you see no evidence of, but that's supposed to occupy the billions of years. But I ask you, how do you measure the time required to produce a gap? All that you see was formed by rapid, catastrophic processes in the geological column, and we suggest that maybe it's time to re-examine the uniformitarian model to see if the flood model might also fit that, although that isn't really the discussion tonight. Thank you.
Dr. Bickford will now make concluding remarks supporting the evolutionist position.
I want to get in my licks about the second law of thermodynamics. Everybody else has had a crack at it. I employ thermodynamics in a lot of my work, dealing with the evolution of igneous and metamorphic rocks. It seems to me that it's quite wrong to equate increasing complexity of living forms with decreasing entropy. Entropy involves increasing randomness. This is expressed in natural physical systems as an increase in the number of possible energy states or configurations. Surely one cannot conclude that evolution of more complex organisms with their billions of specialized cells does not provide increasing availability of configurations or states. Rather, it seems to me that it is the reverse. However, it's clear that many natural systems do, in fact, proceed spontaneously in the direction of decreasing entropy, or that is, of increasing orderliness. A good example of this from the kind of work that I do is the crystallization of magma or molten rock material. Crystallization of anything from the liquid to the solid state provides an increase in orderliness and therefore a decrease in entropy. This happens spontaneously. Now, the statement that all irreversible processes tend towards greater entropy is a very, very general statement indeed. It requires only that the entropy of the universe increase through time. It does not require that individual systems always spontaneously proceed in directions of increasing entropy. Okay, and finally, thank you. Finally, I want to comment on Dr. Morris's remarks just a minute ago about the geologic column. Yes, of course, it is true that many sedimentary deposits show evidences of having been formed during catastrophic events. It's also true that many of them show evidence of having been formed by slow accretion and accumulation of sedimentary material over very long periods of time. That's not the point. The point is, we know the age of the Earth, we know the age of the geologic column. It is possible, by dating igneous rocks, which intrude sedimentary rocks to bracket the position of sedimentary rocks in the geologic column. It is known, for example, that rocks of Cambrian age are at least 550 million years old. Perhaps they're somewhat older than that. It's been possible, by hard work over a long period of time, to place absolute ages in many, many places in the geologic column. And one must ask, I think, how a special creation model explains the observed distribution of fossils. Why is it that there aren't any amphibians in Cambrian rocks? Why is it? Why aren't there any reptiles in Devonian rocks? Why does the fossil record clearly show a progression of ever more specialized forms? If special creation occurred, how did it occur? Did it occur one step at a time? Starting about 3 billion years ago with special creation of blue-green algae, and then special creation of every other group at intervals of several hundred million years. I hope our opponents will comment somewhat on that. Thank you.
And now concluding remarks by the special creationists will be made by Dr. Gish, and then we'll go directly into a question and answer session.
Now, during Dr. Wiley's formal presentation, I almost concluded he had conceded one of the most important points that we had made this evening when he said, all right, the gaps are real, but after all, the theory, the neo-Darwinian theory, is only one theory of evolution that would predict transitional forms, but there are other theories that would predict gaps and the lack of transitional forms. Well, I thought he'd almost said, well, if you can't beat them, join them. And so he conceded the gaps were real, the transitional forms were not found, and therefore we just have another theory of evolution that explains the gap. Well, of course, the evolutionists have been searching intensely for nearly 200 years or so, or 150 years at least, for these transitional forms. And it's amazing to me, of course, that they'd be searching so intensely for something that their theory would predict wouldn't be there in the first place. Or at least now they must modify their theory, not having found what they would predict, to try to account for the gap. Now, the theory of creation, or our model of creation, directly predicts the gap, the lack of transitional forms. We couldn't take any other position. There wouldn't be any other position open to us. Now, clearly on the basis of these assumed gradual changes in evolution, which is accepted by practically every evolutionist, then you would predict the presence of the transitional form. And the lack or the not finding those transitional forms seems to me would be fatal to the theory. Dr. Kitt says evolution requires intermediate forms, but the fossil record does not produce them. But now finally, after it seems to me conceding that point, now Dr. Wiley is arguing that after all, here is Archaeopteryx and it is a transitional form. Now, I'm not sure just exactly what theory of evolution then he is supporting, one that predicts the transitional form or one that predicts the gap, or perhaps one that is a mix of the two. Now concerning this Archaeopteryx, by the way, may I have slide number six, slide number six. I want to take a look at Archaeopteryx. And while that slide is coming up, let me quote from a book called Biology and Comparative Physiology of Birds, edited by Marshall, published by Academic Press in 1960. In Volume 1, we find Chapter 1 is written by Dr. W. E. Swinton, a leading expert on reptiles and birds. Now, this man is an evolutionist, an expert in his fields. He says on page 1 of that chapter, quote, "The origin of birds is largely a matter of deduction. There is no fossil evidence of the stages to which remarkable change from reptile to bird was achieved," unquote. Now, this man believes that you can deduce the origin of birds from reptiles, but he says there is no fossil evidence. Now, Lecomte de Noy, who also was an evolutionist, in his book Human Destiny, published in 1947, on page 58, he says, quote, "In spite of the fact that it is undeniably related to the two classes of reptiles and birds, parenthesis, a relation which the anatomy and physiology of actually living specimens demonstrates, parenthesis, we are not even authorized to consider the exceptional case of the Archaeopteryx as a true link. By link, we mean a necessary stage of transition between classes, such as reptiles and birds, or between smaller groups. An animal displaying characters belonging to two different groups cannot be treated as a true link, as long as the intermediary stages have not been found, and as long as the mechanisms of transition remain unknown," unquote. Now, here's two evolutionists who, in one case, de Noy says, you cannot consider Archaeopteryx as a true link, and in the other, Swinton says that we have no fossil evidence. So I believe even in this case, evolutionists refute the claim that Archaeopteryx is really a true link or provide the fossil evidence necessary to document the transition. Now, here on this slide, we see a picture of Archaeopteryx. And it was a bird. It had feathers identical to those of modern birds. It had wings. It flew. It had teeth, as was pointed out. But, you know, again, you and I have teeth. And if we are going to accept the fact that Archaeopteryx had teeth proves it had a reptilian ancestry, then we consider it proved that you and I have had a reptilian ancestry because we have teeth. And reptiles have teeth. Now, furthermore, we must recognize and be aware of the fact that there were other ancient birds in the fossil record which had no teeth. Some ancient birds had teeth and some did not, but we do not have intermediates showing the evolution of the toothed bird into the toothless bird. You have the two types, but no intermediate stages. Now, furthermore, we find this absence or presence of teeth true of all of the subclasses of the vertebrates. Some fishes have teeth, some don't. Some amphibians have teeth, some don't. Some reptiles have teeth, some don't. Most mammals have teeth, but some don't. Most of you have teeth, and some don't. But we can't use that truly as a final genetic, we might say, proof of any kind. Now, the bird did have claws on the wings, but we find that other birds living today have claws. Next slide, please. Here's a picture of the Huatzin, a bird that is very much a bird, as you will recognize, a bird living in South America today. Next slide. We'll show the juvenile Huatzin, which indeed has two claws. There's one claw there, and there's the other claw. There's a bird living today that has claws. Now, if you could find him as a fossil, I suppose someone could claim he was a transitional form, but he's very much alive and well today. The Turaco of Africa has claws, and the ostrich has claws. Truly, if you wanted to, you could say they were more reptile-like than the claws in Archaeopteryx. That here we see, again, morphological characteristics shared in common by different classes, but not in any way indicating that one had evolved from the other. Now, there are other so-called reptilian features in this bird which we don't have time to discuss. Now, he said that this bird is really nothing more than a feathered reptile. Now, really, ladies and gentlemen, I find that very difficult to believe. At least I have yet to find a reptile that all you have to do is stick a bunch of feathers in him, kick him in the tail, and he's going to take off and fly. There's a very great difference, I believe, between a bird, and this bird did fly. There's some argument about his ability, but he did fly, and he had complete 100% feathers. What we point out, when you find feathers, they are complete. They are not intermediate. Now, that's all for the slide right now. Thank you. Now, about this geological column and its supposed succession. May we have the light, please? Our evolutionary friends have maintained that there is a continuum in the geological column. In the Cambrian, we have the invertebrates. And then later on, we have the fishes or the vertebrates and so forth. Now, there are some really difficulties with that. Now, they say your explanation why we don't find fishes in the Cambrian is inadequate. It just really doesn't do the job. Now, recently, they have found the remains of heterostracan fishes in the earliest Ordovician. Now, the Ordovician is supposed to be the geological period succeeding the Cambrian. They have found fossils of heterostracan fishes in the very earliest Ordovician. Now, they are fully formed. They are fishes, fully heterostracan fishes. Now, if that's true, if they were present in the earliest Ordovician, they had to evolve down in the Cambrian. They didn't appear overnight, you see. Millions of years were required for the evolution of the invertebrates and the vertebrates. Some evolutionists estimate as many as 100 million years. All right, now, if you find heterostracan fishes in the earliest Ordovician, based upon evolutionary assumptions, then he had to be in existence in the Cambrian. He had to be. But he's not found there. Now, if you are not satisfied with the creationist explanation, then let's hear a better explanation. The evolutionist has to explain this data also, you see. What is their data now, or their explanation? Their explanation, previous explanation, was, well, you don't find him there because he hadn't yet evolved. He evolved in the middle or late Ordovician, so he just simply wasn't there. But now, with this new data, when he's known to be in existence in the very earliest Ordovician, he had to be present in the Cambrian, but he's not found there. Furthermore, we find cuttlefish in the earliest Cambrian. This is a recent report by Wyatt and Durham of the University of California at Berkeley. Cuttlefish are not fishes, by the way. They are invertebrates, but they are a very complex predator. And it has been assumed that there were no predators of that kind, at least down in the Cambrian. They had not evolved until the Jurassic. Now, the Jurassic, I think, is roughly 400 million years or so after the Cambrian. And the explanation, the evolutionary explanation, why you don't find them in the Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, Mississippian, Pennsylvanian, and so forth, they simply had not yet evolved. But now, these fossils have been found in the earliest Cambrian. but they have not yet been found in Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, Mississippian, Pennsylvanian, so forth. Well, why not? What is the evolutionary explanation? If you don't like our sorting or ecological niche or geographical idea, then let's have a better explanation. But it is not certainly, it certainly demonstrates that this idea of a continuum through time is certainly not quite clear. Well, I wished I had more time, but we've run out. It's been a delight, been a great pleasure. Dr. Wiley and Dr. Bickford have been very gracious gentlemen, and we appreciate very much this time with you this evening. Thank you very much.
I know that everyone on stage recognizes what a superb audience you've been this evening. Let me remind you that if you wish further information on either side of this issue, you can contact any member of the KU Evolutionists, any member of the KU Creationist Organization, or History of Science, of course, is available to serve as a referee. And we'll be teaching a course next year on science and religion, which will deal with these very issues. And now, if you have questions, and we want to alternate the questions, please, from one side to the other, will you come to this microphone and ask your question? And please be as brief as possible. We're ready for the question. You have a question.
Which side? If I can, my question is directed to the creationist. If I remember correctly, approximately a year back, I saw on an educational TV network an episode of the science program NOVA in which they capitalized the works of such people as Stanley Miller, the works with the primordial soup and all this. And if I remember correctly, they demonstrated an experiment where they took a combination of these primordial soups, took a piece of, if you will, volcanic rock, heated it to a rather extreme temperature with an acetylene torch or such, splashed, if you will, this primordial soup upon the rock, rinsed it off with water, repeated this, and came up with a very minute type of cell, if you will, that exhibited a form of budding. Now, as if you say, there are only certain times when evolution was able to perform this jump, if you will, only certain periods, I don't know specifically how you characterize them, that life could have come up, that life could have drastically changed, why is man, at this time, able to create something of this form?
A little difficult for us to understand all that's being said. Now, I believe Dr. Morris has interpreted for me that it's talking about these origin of life experiments, and I believe it has to do with that. Well, let me deal with that specific question. Now, I have slide number 25 up there. I want to demonstrate what has been done in this origin of life area. Is that your question, having to do with the origin of life? Here's the apparatus used by Stanley Miller in his classical experiment, which is supposed to demonstrate the plausibility of a mechanistic origin of life. Now, he circulated the assumed gases of the primitive Earth, methane, ammonia. By the way, there's no evidence that the Earth ever had such a methane ammonia atmosphere, and there's much evidence against it. But nevertheless, let's assume this was true. He circulated the gases with electrical discharge. Now, down the bottom of the apparatus, you notice a trap in which the product, the instant was formed, was immediately trapped out. Now, after about a week of this experiment, Dr. Miller tested the solution in the bottom of the trap, or in the trap, and found that it contained a few of the amino acids found in living things. Glycine, aspartic acid, glutamic acid, alanine, stuff like that. Now, this was supposed then to prove a mechanistic origin of life. First of all, the results were extremely trivial. A few amino acids are infinitely removed from a living thing. The fact that you could build a few bricks in no way indicates that you're going to get the building, because the bricks must be arranged in a highly precise order, and many, many other things must be there. Secondly, Dr. Miller imposed upon this experiment something that could not exist on the primitive earth, and in any case would be fatal to the order of life. He put a trap in the apparatus. Now, Dr. Miller did this because he knew that the rate of destruction of those products far exceeded the rate of synthesis. And if the products in turn were subjected to the energy source, that is, electrical discharges, they would be destroyed. And so he had to trap them out, prevent their contact with electrical discharge. Well, unfortunately, there were no organic chemists or apparatus like this on the primitive earth. Next slide will show the scenario of the origin of life, electrical discharges, ultraviolet light, gases give the products, which then filter down to the ocean, and there are converted to amino acids. Well, the time of fallout, half time of fallout, is about 3 years. And so these products would be destroyed by the radioactive, the electrical discharges, ultraviolet light, at just a tremendous rate that no significant quantity would reach the ocean in the first place. Certainly of complex compounds. Now, glycine, the simplest amino acid, the 2-carbon amino acid, about 97% of that would be destroyed before it reached the ocean. And even after it reached the ocean, the rate of destruction is so high, no significant quantity would be found that is in an equilibrium state. Now, a more complex compound like sugar, it has been estimated that hardly a single molecule in the whole universe would be found in something, some system like this. Now, next slide, we'll give the conclusions of Dr. D.E. Hall, published in Nature in 1960. A review of Miller's work and other work like this. Dr. Hall said this. He said, the physical chemist, guided by the proved principles of chemical thermodynamics and kinetics, cannot offer any encouragement to the biochemist, that is, the ordinary life chemist, who needs an ocean full of organic compounds to form even lifeless coacervates. Unquote. Now, Hall said this was based upon proved principles, chemical thermodynamics and kinetics, and it is true. The rate of destruction of these compounds is so high that you can get no significant quantity accumulating. Now, if you imagine you've got a trap somewhere, you haven't solved the problem. As a matter of fact, you're dead. If you trap out those amino acids, that's the end of the line. They're not going anywhere. They're not going to protein, because to build amino acids into proteins requires energy. Every step in the order of life requires energy. If you hide it under a rock or something like that where there's no energy available, then it's dead. It's not going any further. But if you introduce energy of any kind, then it destroys the product. At a much greater rate than there's any possibility to promote it to a higher product. And when you take all of these factors into consideration, we find that not only does this work not prove the origin of life, but when it's carefully evaluated, you can, as Hull has said, on the basis of proved principles, you can give no encouragement to this idea of an origin of life. And particularly when you must arrange hundreds of amino acids in a highly ordered and precise sequence to have a biologically active molecule. To think that those could be ordered in the precise order necessary by chance processes, by laws of chemistry and physics, is absolutely contrary to the known fact. A monkey can type nonsense, but he can't produce a message. And that same thing is true of physical chemistry.
Excuse me, doctor. Doctor, one other thing that, to a point, contradicts the thing you said. In this same NOVA program, they introduced an experiment that I believe took place 2 or 3 years back out in the Mojave Desert, the essence of which was they took this primordial soup in small samples, in closed test tubes, if you will, and, in essence, laid them out in the sun and were able to build very short, 3, 4, 5 amino acid in length chain of amino acids.
Oh, okay. Now you're talking about taking amino acids and heating them at a high temperature and polymerizing them into short chain polymer.
Well, actually, I don't believe they indicated heat as much as the solar energy itself, the radiation.
Well, now, the solar energy won't do it. But now, Fox, for example, he's taken dry, pure amino acids, put them in a test tube, heated them up, and got polymers from this. Now, if you continue heating them beyond about 6 hours, it destroys the product. So he has to limit the time very precisely. But now, the fatal thing here is this. These people have put pure amino acids in their mixture. Now, there's only one place that I can think of on this earth where you can find a mixture of pure amino acids. And that would be in the laboratory of a 20th century scientist. On the hypothetical primordial earth, you'd have all that chemical evolution going on, supposedly, generating sugars, generating ketones, aldehydes, acids of all kinds. Now, if you take these, it's impossible to have a mixture of pure amino acids on the primitive earth. Take those amino acids, throw them in with sugars. What happens? The sugars destroy the amino acids. Throw them in with amines, you terminate your chain. You got no carboxylic acid group. Put them in with acids, you terminate your chain. You got no amino group. You put these things with other chemicals, heat them up, and you're going to get absolute junk. You're absolutely going to get no polymers. And even if you start with pure amino acids, you get only randomly arranged amino acids. And the number of ways that you can arrange amino acids is almost infinite. Take 100 amino acids. Can be arranged in 10 to 130th different ways. Now, how are you going to get the precise order found, for example, in human growth hormone or in an enzyme or some other biological active compound? How do you get that order? Now, physics and chemistry cannot do that. You can't do it any more than monkeys can do it. Physics and chemistry are just dumb things like monkeys.
Dr. Bickford and Dr. Wiley, would you like to comment? Next question. Director here.
My question is directed to Dr. Wiley. You stated at the outset of your presentation that it was your intent tonight to separate what is science from what is personal opinion, under which, I believe I'm quoting you fairly there, under which of these two classifications do you classify your statement, life originally came from non-life?
In reference to which model, the creation model or the evolution model?
This was your statement, and I'm wanting to ask you,
whether
you say this as though it were a scientific tenet or whether this is merely your personal opinion.
No, this is a prediction. You see the creationist prediction was life comes from only life. And they say that the evolutionist says that life comes from non-life. I was simply clarifying that and saying that originally life only came from non-life. I also pointed out that these were predictions which were not testable. I was not the one who brought up these predictions. It was the scientific creationist who brought up these predictions. I was just trying to make the best out of what I could.
May I follow?
Dr. Morris, Dr. Gish, would you like to comment?
I think here again maybe is a misunderstanding of what the creationist prediction, call it that, may have been. The evolutionist does, that is, most evolutionists at least, believe that life originated by natural random processes from non-living chemicals. We've been discussing that. Stanley Miller's experiments were to that end, and so on. We've tried to show that there is no possibility that life, in its extreme complexity, could arise from non-living chemicals by any natural process. Life can only come from life. The first life must have come from life just as well as modern life, and this, we suggest, is good evidence in support of the creation model, which postulates a creator who has life and who is therefore able to create life.
Life comes from non-life. That depends on what you call. Yes, certainly you can invoke a creator, and you can say since the creator was living, life comes from life. However, most traditions, and I'm not talking about the scientific theory, I'm talking about the religious traditions, most religious traditions says that life came from earth. Non-living earth. Perhaps I'm simply mistaken here, but perhaps there's a clarification call for.
Well, I happen to be, engaged in religious work, and I certainly don't say that life came from earth. I say that life
came from pre-existing life, which always was, and the Bible certainly doesn't say that life came from earth. It says man's body came from earth.
We have the next question,
okay.
Please.
Excuse me. Yeah, I don't want to get into discussion, but I also stated that since neither model was untestable, neither one could be used to compare the two schools. So what's the big issue?
The big issue is it's personal opinion both ways.
Oh, okay. As long as you can see that, that's fine. Both ways.
Next question.
Can I get a comment there?
So both sides deserve an equal hearing in the academic setting.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've got to the crux of the problem. Now, I was accused of not saying anything positive about evolution. Of the 12 predictions I went over, 5 predictions were exactly the same between the creationists and the evolutionists. One prediction was untestable. Life comes from non-life. One prediction was very vague. Let's see, how many does that make? 5, 9, 10, 11. Yeah, 2 were very vague. Okay? I pointed out that where they differ and they were testable, the evolutionist model was verified and the creationist, scientific creationist model was falsified. Now, I'm not claiming that creation didn't happen. I'm claiming this particular theory of special creation is falsified by the scientific evidence. If that is so, do we want to teach falsified theories? Surely, if we look at a globe, maybe we should also give all the corroborating instances of flat Earth. There are people who really believe in flat Earth. Okay? And if we're going to then look at all of the corroborating instances of a flat Earth versus a round Earth, it's kind of analogous to looking at all of the corroborating instances of special creation versus this particular theory of special creation. Let me make this very clear. This particular theory as compared to evolution.
Now,
that's again.
Let me say, first of all, I trust that Dr. Wiley does not intend to associate our position with the flat earth people. We do not want to be identified with people of that kind. But this subject of the origin of life is not a matter of opinion. When Dr. Hull, who is a qualified chemical thermodynamicist and physical chemist, says that proved principles of chemical thermodynamics and kinetics demonstrate that these compounds could not arise, you see, by these processes, then that's not a matter of personal opinion, that's a matter of scientific data. And you go in the laboratory and you subject these compounds to this kind of treatment and you measure the equilibrium concentration that Dr. Hull has done. He found that the equilibrium concentration of glycine was 10 to the minus 24th molar, or thereabouts, which is essentially infinite dilution. And the concentration of glucose under these supposed conditions would be 10 to the minus 134th molar. That means you couldn't find one single molecule in the entire universe if the entire universe one big chemical reaction. Now that is based upon proved principles, not a matter of personal opinion. If one holds the idea that life has evolved, it is a personal opinion, it's a matter of faith, that it contradicts known data, known good scientific data, and therefore we say the origin of life by mechanistic means is impossible. It's literally impossible. And the only alternative anybody's ever been able to think of is that of creation, spatial creation. Therefore, at least, our model seems to be more credible on that basis than the evolution model.
You have a question for over here?
Yeah. My question is directed to Dr. Morris. I'd like to ask him, since your job really is to defend the creationist model, if you couldn't perhaps comment on the simple probability theory you use to attack the evolutionist viewpoint in order to explain exactly what gives you the faith to attribute that to God.
I guess I missed something. Would you mind repeating? I didn't follow you.
Certainly. The question is, you used probability theory very admirably in order to attack the evolutionist theory, but you never applied that same probability theory to your creation theory in order to prove that God was responsible for that theory.
Oh. All right. I'll have to go back and remind you of the two models. The creation model and the evolution model, these are the two alternatives. They're not 1,000 different theories of origins. They're 2 basic models, creation and evolution. so that positive evidence for one is negative for the other, and vice versa. Now,
I'm afraid that's not good enough. You're going to have to show exactly why
let me illustrate.
Why the probability falls in that direction.
Perhaps I'm missing the point of your question, but if you're asking about the calculation of the probability of a random set of random processes generating a high degree of complexity, I thought that was a fairly straightforward calculation. No one has refuted that, as far as I know. Now, that tells us, therefore, this is the evolution model says that random processes generate higher complexity. Probability theory says no. Probability theory says random processes will never generate a higher degree of order from a lower degree of order. And this is confirmed by all experiments that we have any knowledge of. Now, conversely, probability theory suggests that the alternative view, since random processes cannot generate higher complexity, therefore there must be creative processes to generate high complexity. There's no other alternative. That's why I say that negative evidence against the one is positive for the other. If there is no possibility of random processes generating complexity, then the high complexity must find its source in a higher degree of complexity, a higher degree of order. And this suggests that the first cause, if you wish, or the creator, or whatever you want to name this originator of complexity, must himself, have at least that higher degree of complexity in the first place.
In other words, you're saying because one theory of evolution has a low probability, therefore you must attribute it to God? Is that the gist of what you're saying?
There are two alternatives. If evolution is impossible, creation is the alternative.
Didn't the negative show many alternatives, many evolutionary alternatives?
We're discussing, again, the general model of evolution, the general model of creation. Evolution in any form cannot generate a high degree of order by random processes.
Dr. Wiley, would you please comment, or is there any embryological evidence to support an evolutionary theory?
May I make another comment on that last question before he deals with this next question?
Hold on.
I just wanted to say, now, it has to do with the validity of the alternative. Now, if you will conclude that the parts of a watch cannot spontaneously arrange themselves into a watch, now I think you would agree that that's not possible, then I think you would agree to the validity that there must be a watchmaker. The only other way you can explain the watch is that there's a watchmaker. If it could not have happened by the laws of chemistry and physics, by random processes, if you can prove it's not true, then I think it's the alternative that there must be a watchmaker who has intelligence, purpose, and is able to do this, that the alternative then is the superior model, which is the creation model.
Did you hear the question? I would like for you to comment on whether there is any embryological evidence to support an evolutionary theory.
Yeah, and it's kind of complicated. I would refer you to Soren Lutstrup's book called Epigenesis, published by John Wiley Company. Unfortunately, it costs $47, so you have to get it out of the library. He bases his entire evolutionary theory on controller gene mutation and what we call epigenetic interaction. In other words, the fate of a cell. See, your brain cell and your skin cell have the same genes in it. Now, why is one a brain cell and why is one a skin cell? This has a lot to do with where that cell happened to be as the egg started multiplying its cells and grew into a blastula, gastro, and, you know, and on like that. So, yes, there is one of our newer theories is very much based on embryological data. It's also very highly theoretical. You see, Soren Lutstrup says, now, here are the things that I predict about development if my theory is true. And he tells you exactly what to go out and look for, which makes it a pristinely scientific model since it can be falsified immediately. In fact, he tells you how to falsify it.
I didn't understand exactly everything that Dr. Wiley said. Let me comment on this idea of embryological recapitulation. This idea that the human embryo, for example, recapitulates its ancestral stages and at one time, for example, has gill slits. Well, this theory has been thoroughly refuted today. it is no longer accepted by knowledgeable embryologists, including the evolutionists. For instance, Walter J. Bach of the Department of Biological Sciences at Columbia, in an article published 9th of May, 1969 in Science, said, quote, on page 684, "The biogenetic law has become so deeply rooted in biological thought that it cannot be weeded out, in spite of it having been demonstrated to be wrong by numerous subsequent scholars," unquote, subsequent to Darwin and people like that. Darwin said the evidence for evolution from embryology was second to none. Bach says it's totally worthless. Dr. Waldo Shumway, an article called The Recapitulation Theory in Quarterly Review of Biology, Volume 7, March of 1932, 44 years ago, said, quote, that is, "the results of experimental embryology, quote, seems to demand that the hypothesis be abandoned." That is the idea of embryological recapitulation. "Those of us who were reared in the phylogenetic tradition may see it go with a sigh of regret. Those of us charged with the responsibility of explaining the law of evolution to our classes will miss a familiar maxim, easily learned and a convenient skeleton on which to hang the discrete data of embryology. But there can be no excuse for continuing to impress plastic minds by means of discredited generalizations," unquote. James W. Leach, in Functional Anatomy in Mammalian Comparative, published in 1961, says on page 44, "But as a law inscribed by nature, i.e., the biogenetic law of recapitulation, it is perhaps more full of loopholes and bypasses than any law thus far inscribed by man." And we could go on and on and on. The theory of embryological recapitulation has been thoroughly discredited. The human embryo does not have gill slits. It has a series of bars and grooves in the neck region where the fish has gill slits. But in the human, these bars and grooves do not open in the throat. They do not become slits. They never develop in respiratory tissue or gills. They are not gills. They are not slits, and they are not gills. Now, if they're not slits and they're not gills, I don't see how we could call them gill slits. This develops in entirely different tissue and organs and so forth. So there's nothing to this idea of embryological recapitulation. Thoroughly discredited theory.
I didn't say anything about recapitulation. I said something about Thorne Lufthrup. His book's been out for 2 years.
We have a question directed to this side.
My question is to either one of the creationists. It's really a four-part series question, but it should be answered pretty easily. I would like to
know... How many parts did you say?
Yeah, but it's real simple.
Can you make it simple?
Yeah. I would like to know what you consider to be the age of the Earth, the first primordial form of life on Earth. What method you use to ascertain this age, and how would you compare that to the evolutionist 3-billion-year-old alga form?
Handle all those?
It's hard for us to hear these questions. Did you ask what is the age of the Earth in our view? Is that what the question was?
In your view.
I said earlier that the subject of the age of the Earth, the young Earth versus the old Earth, could very well be the subject of an entire separate debate. And I would prefer to suggest that you, rather than just taking a flat statement as to what we believe, allow us to have the time sometime to back it up.
Okay.
Now, let me say this much.
I can clarify my question.
Pardon?
Well, you said that sometime back in time that there was a initial form of plant life, if I understood you right. And that prior to that, there had been no intermediate form of plant. And I was going to say that if the former plant at that certain age were highly developed, and from that they developed, why could the evolutionists say that there had been a prior form of life to that?
I guess it's because it's getting late. You said because the first plant life was complex, What did we say about the precursor of that? Was that your question?
Well, I thought you said at a certain time, sometime back, there was a, when the thing was created, that there was a certain form of life, correct? And that was?
The creation model suggests that all life was created. It did not evolve from non-life, and it furthermore suggests that the basic forms of life, that is, the basic kinds of plants and animals, and especially the mankind, were created as those forms. In other words, man was created as man, not from an ape-like ancestor. And the same with the basic forms of plants and animals all through. Now, that's what the creation says, and we suggest that probably that was in a creation period, but the basic creation model does not say when that was.
Okay.
Now, the biblical record does, if you want to bring the biblical revelation of creation, and it does say that.
Okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. I'll retract my question.
Should we possibly get you to ask those other questions afterwards? Because you really asked four questions.
Well, okay, I'll talk to him later then.
Good.
Thank you.
You have a question for over here?
Mr. Wiley, or Dr. Wiley, presented Dr. Popper's comments on what constitutes a good scientific theory. And Dr. Popper, in his book, Conjectures and Refutations, stressed repeatedly that a good theory refutes actual certain observations or certain events from happening. If these events happen, they would destroy the theory. And if the theory does not refute any, it's unscientific. I would like to know what events or observations evolution in general forbids. Not specific ones, but the whole theory or idea of evolution in general.
It forbids a decrease in entropy as the universe evolves. How's that? Did you want more?
One would separate it
you
from
want more?
Creation. That's the same thing that creation forbids.
Oh. I didn't know that we had to forbid everything they had to forbid.
Now, what difference?
I'm not trying to get you. I'm just trying to be a little clearer. Okay, look, certain theories do have prohibitions. Okay, for example, the neo-Darwinian theory has a prohibition against gaps. That then becomes a scientific theory. That's, you know, in a lot of circumstances, it seems to me, where you have gaps, the neo-Darwinian theory perhaps falls flat on its face. It's false upon. There you go.
What I am trying to suggest is rather, if you cannot come up with one thing for evolution in general, the fact that neither of these are really good scientific theories according to Popper's criteria and must be decided by personal opinion outside the realm of science.
Okay, let me give you some. And remember, even if they're the same as the creationist theories, they're still predictions and therefore they are prohibitions. Okay? There can be no decrease in entropy as the universe as a whole. Okay? There's one. Stars cannot just... Well, okay. I'll give you another one. I'll give you one from astronomy, although I'm not an astronomer. Certain cosmology theories that are based on evolution say that stars go through a particular sequence before they hit the main sequence. There are various ways of getting through the main sequence. Okay? A refutation of that would say that that cosmologist is wrong. Okay? Now there isn't any doubt whatsoever, and as I said, there isn't any doubt whatsoever that you can't prove anything. Right? You can't prove anything. And all of your beliefs, religious or otherwise, are basically metaphysical when you strip everything away. What we can do is to look at theories. I've looked at the scientific creationist theory. I think it's a good scientific theory. It makes predictions which can be going out, you know, not all the predictions are observable, but then not all the predictions of the process of evolution are observable either. Or the neo-Darwinian theory has certain prohibitions. You can go out and test those. You can test the scientific creationist. The only point I'd like to make, since I had the negative tonight, was that scientific creationism is a refuted theory. Now, if you go to absolutes, Popper doesn't apply there, and he tells you that as well, if you've read him. There is no absolute falsification. There is no absolute verification. There is no absolute prediction. Because after all we are a thing, you know, I mean, we're a lot of things, but as scientists, we have eyes and we have brains and we try to use them as best we can. And we try to produce the best theories we can.
But Popper also, in another article, for example, said that, and this is a direct statement almost, I don't remember exact words,
yeah.
But he said that natural selection, which is a key to nearly every theory of evolution,
only
is
if you,
not a good scientific
Oh, yeah,
theory.
Right. That's right. Natural selection, viewed in the way that G.G. Simpson viewed it, is a tautology. But I'm not viewing natural selection in that way. I'm viewing it exactly like these gentlemen are here, as a conservative force. Yes, I agree.
Dr. Gish wants to make a comment.
Let me try to explain why evolution theory is a non-falsifiable theory, and the same is true of creation. For example, if in evolution theory you could make a precise prediction, let's say on the basis of evolution theory you are going to predict the presence in the fossil record of transition forms. Now that's your prediction. Now, you go to the fossil record and you look for these transition forms and you don't find them. Now you falsified your theory. But you see, that can't be done in evolution, as Dr. Wiley himself has demonstrated here tonight, because he says you just come up with an alternative. You use a secondary modification of your theory, and now you've got your theory predicting the gaps, you see. And now, let's say you make this prediction, and later on, let's say you assume you found a transitional form. Now you falsify, go back to your original theory. The thing is that evolution has been made so plastic it can prove anything and everything. No matter what the data is, it can be made to fit. Now you can do the same thing with creation theory. Neither theory is falsifiable. Let me quote from this mathematical challenge. It's the Neo-Darwinian Interpretation of Evolution published by the Wistar Institute in 1967. Again, Dr. Murray Eden, on page 71, talking about falsifiability, said, quote, "This cannot be done in evolution, taking it in its broad sense. And this is really all I meant when I called it tautologist in the first place. It can indeed explain anything. You may be ingenious or not in proposing a mechanism which looks plausible to human beings and mechanisms which are consistent with other mechanisms which you have discovered. But it is still an unfalsifiable theory." Unquote.
Yeah, as I said, natural selection viewed in that way is an unfalsifiable theory because it's a tautology. Tautologies cannot be tested. However, that's only one theory. I think Dr. Gish confuses theory with process. We suggest that there is the process of evolution. There are theories which have been produced to explain the process. Those are the things that you test. Now, Dr. Gish suggests that there is a process of creation. Fine. I mean, you know, that's okay too. Does the one theory that's been proposed and purporting to be and is, and which I think is scientific, is this refuted in the same way as any other good scientific theory? Yes, it is. Now, that doesn't refute their process, ladies and gentlemen. That doesn't necessarily, the fact that the scientific creationists have had their theory falsified does not necessarily mean that their process is incorrect. Okay? So let's get that clear right now. Thank you.
One or two more questions. 5 minutes. So if you make it short, that'll give the next man a chance.
This question is directed to Dr. Morris and Dr. Gish. In reference to their comments about the non-gill slits in the human fetuses or what have you, if they're not gill slits, what are they? They seem to be devolved something. Okay, they appear to be formerly have been gills in previous stages of man, and since you concede the fact of a horizontal evolution, what were these before they became non-gillsless?
These structures in the human embryo?
These
structures in the human embryo are pharyngeal pouches, or you may refer them to some other terms if you want to call them pharyngeal pouches. Then that might be a pretty good terminology, but to call them gill slits is totally erroneous. They're not slits and they're not gills, you see. There's strictly a superficial resemblance. that those pharyngeal pouches in man develop into the middle ear, the lower jaw, the thymus gland, and things like that. You see, they don't develop into respiratory tissue. Certainly don't develop into gills or slits or anything like that, you see. This idea, then, of taking that superficial resemblance and say, look, that proves evolution because we're recapitulating, it's just not right. It doesn't. Now, another refutation is the human tongue appears before the teeth, the brain before the nerve cords, and the heart before the blood vessel. Now, that's contradictory to the recapitulation theory, you see. And so, because of this and many other reasons, the theory has been abandoned. It's been falsified. It has been clearly falsified. Now, again, as Dr. Wiley says, it doesn't falsify evolution. It falsifies embryological recapitulation ideas.
Dr. Wiley, you stated that natural selection is a conservative force. Could you elaborate on a current model or theory which would serve as a progressive or upbuilding mechanism for evolution?
Well, I did my original presentation. It would take a couple of hours to elaborate it in all its details. Essentially, what it amounts to is that one does not get a elaboration of the functional genes, the genes which actually code for enzymes which work in your body every day. What one does is modify the control systems for those functional genes. Now, we know through studies with E. coli and other type of bacterial strains, how this control mechanism works. Okay? We can do crosses. We can look at how the mechanism works. The interesting thing about the interesting difference between bacteria and things like man is not the functional genes. It's what we call the repetitive DNA. There are hundreds and hundreds of times more DNA in our bodies than there is in a bacteria. It's not the functional genes. It's those controller genes which are elaborated. Two of the theories suggest that these controller genes can, in fact, be used to modify the sequence of development in order to produce something that looked like something different than its ancestor. Now, this is by no means an established fact. It is an initial tentative hypothesis, which is grounded on firm genetic basis to attempt to explain gaps. Now, I don't know what simple to complex means. The paramecium, which is a single-celled organism, is the most complex single-celled organism I've ever seen. One of our brain cells is probably one of the simplest cell that you'll ever see. I would suggest that this so-called thing about complexity is making simple cells do more things in aggregates. I mean, you know, I don't know what simple and complex are in this case. Any other? I mean, you know, okay.
I'd like to make a comment on that. Now, Dr. Wiley is saying that just changing the structural genes, that is the genes governing the structure of protein, let's say enzymes and things like that, it's obviously not sufficient to explain evolution. Of course, I would certainly hardly agree with that. Now he's suggesting, and this is suggestions by Claire King and Camel and people like that, suggesting that you must have an evolution of the control system, the control gene. Now, really, you have multiplied your difficulties. Because these control systems of genes, and let me say, first of all, really, we know very little about them. I have not the slightest doubt in my mind that such complexes exist. They must exist to explain why we see something like that. Now, the control system, however, is really vastly more complex than, say, the gene that controls a single structure of, say, human growth hormone or hemoglobin or something like that. These control systems involve complexes of genes. Some of these genes are found on different chromosomes. Now, somehow, by accident, by some mistake, you've got to change that control system so that it acts in a purposeful and beneficial way. Now you have complexes of genes controlling a single characteristic. You may have 15, 20, 30 genes, maybe more, maybe many more controlling a single characteristic. You've got a control system. How are you going to, at random, by accident, by mistake, change that incredibly complex control system so that it changes your mechanism without completely throwing the whole thing out of out of kilter. And how are you going to explain increasing complexity? How are you going to explain the origin of new control systems? You've got to have new control systems. You go from an animal that has no eyes to an animal that has eyes. It's got to have you've got to explain the origin of new control systems. Now, how are you going to do that? By accident, mistake? I just seem to me it's an incredible theory that you can make these mistakes and change an incredibly complex system in a directional and beneficial way.
This must be an incredibly complex thing, but in fact, one single controller gene can control those 25 things, those 25 functional genes. So that, okay, let's say we have a mutation of a functional gene. It doesn't produce very much effect. Let's say that we have a mutation of a controller gene. It produces an effect in order of 25 times. It controls 25 genes. If this happens at the stage before the organism has even started dividing, it's going to have a profound effect. Now, I'm not saying it's true. I'm not even saying it's been well tested. I'm saying it's an alternative. I'm saying that this shows that evolution is going in new directions, producing new theories, some of them very highly controversial. We're glad they're controversial. But as far as affecting a large change, you say, well, then how do you get these new control systems? You get it by a very simple process called DNA duplication, which has been observed, at least in the laboratory in one instance, which is house-mouse satellite DNA, which occurred before our very eyes. Now, if you look at something like an amphibian, it has much more DNA than we do. Much, much more DNA. In other words, it has more bits of information. A lungfish, for instance. Why is that? Well, I don't know why that is. Obviously, a lot of that stuff doesn't function at all, but it's available to function. It's available to function. It's available to modify the code.
Ladies and gentlemen, we thank you for your attention, and if you have more questions, please come to the edge of the stage and ask away. Thank you.